Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. American history is full of important people whose names we recognize, but often know in broad outlines or simple caricatures. One such individual is Andrew Carnegie, industrialist and philanthropist. He is much more complex and much more interesting than either of these single words would indicate. In order to get a better understanding of this late 19th century industrial leader, my guest today is Dr. Jeff Smith, Senior Professor of History at Lindenwood University. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Most people probably are familiar with Carnegie through his philanthropic work, but his origin story plays a large role in creating that philanthropist. Where does he begin?
I think there are two origin stories for Andrew Carnegie. One of them is the de facto, what really is his origin. And the other is the origin story that Andrew Carnegie liked to tell, and the one that he liked to imagine was a sort of an origin. So what is it? Well, what do we know? Born in 1835 in Dunfermline, Scotland, good, solid, middle-class family, oldest of two sons of a fairly prosperous, skilled weaver, Will Carnegie. But Will Carnegie's fortunes turned in the 1840s when a textile mill opened up in Dunfermline. And one of the things it did was it put people like him out of business. And so instead of having several looms and a couple of apprentices, Will Carnegie is down to just one and ended up having to sell it. And so they ended up moving to the United States. In fact, he had to, ended up having to borrow money to come to the United States even. So Carnegie liked this version, he liked to think of it as a rags to riches. Oh, he says he arrived in America as a penniless Scotsman. Well, sort of. But he also came in with literacy. He came in with a degree of what we might call social conventions. They came out of a prosperous, middle-class, reasonably well-to-do family and those values. He liked the idea of being the sort of rags to riches, poor boy made good. He comes here and he gets a couple of jobs in assorted factories, ends up working for a telegraph company, learns telegraphy, which, by the way, is what a lot of young boys and young men would have done working there. It was kind of like being in the IT business of 1850. He learns that on his own. He gets hired by Tom Scott at the Pennsylvania Railroad. He works his way up the ranks there. He loves this narrative. In fact, his narrative is one where, well, industrialization killed my dad's business. They came here. His father never really adjusted particularly, died in the early 1850s. So for him, that origin story plays into his notions about democracy. And that's part of his origin story, too. See, he's got a philosophical origin story to go with it all. And the philosophical origin story goes back to his father and his uncle, who were old Chartists back in Scotland. This is the group that says, we need to have some kind of a charter, a constitution here in the British Isles. And they were going to be working for that. He remembers seeing his father and uncle standing up and speaking in favor of this. So when they come here, Carnegie will later say, he says, but that was what helped inherited wealth keep its power, but it wasn't so here in America. And as a result of that, we Americans, we can rise to be whatever we wish to. Why, just look at me, a penniless Scotsman who has become a billionaire. And so he's got this philosophical origin that rags to riches also plays into, favoring an America as he wants to see it, as one where democracy allows anyone to rise as high as their talents and their aspirations will take.
It's interesting to note that he, I believe J.P. Morgan says that at one point he is the richest man in the world. And yeah, whether that's true or not is a different story. But how does that happen? How does he go from being this penniless Scot to possibly being the wealthiest man?
Well, again, there's sort of two narratives. There's the historical record narrative, and then there's the gospel according to St. Andrew version of it. And they're fairly close, actually. He becomes an industrialist. He's working for the Pennsylvania Railroad through the Civil War. And while he's there, here's what he notices. He says, boy, you know, the trains are getting bigger all the time and longer. And he says, but you know what? The bridges aren't. And so we're going to need to deal with that, what we would call infrastructure problem at some stage. And so he invests in a company called the Keystone Bridge Company and becomes its vice president. And it becomes a company that's going to build big, right after the war, build big river-spanning bridges. Two of the first three spanning the Mississippi River were built by Keystone, including the Illinois and St. Louis Bridge, the so-called Eads Bridge. And that's where you can see his thought process on vertical integration. And that's, in a way, how a man like me gets to be a man like me, if you will. First, he says, well, if we're using all this iron, why don't I have an iron foundry? Do business with myself. If they're going to be using all this steel, well, buy a steel mill. Start making it myself. And then down the road, he'll start doing other things. Well, if we're using all this coal and coke for fuel, why don't I just buy a coal and coke company, and so on and so forth. So what happens, though, is that steel comes to eclipse the bridge business. He becomes the largest producer of steel rails on the planet because he's in the right place at the right time with the right product. He's got steel rails starting in the early 1870s when rail expansion, not just in the United States, but other places too, is just going through the roof. And because he believes in, quote, progress and technology and its progress, he's constantly figuring out ways to make more product at a cheaper per unit cost. So unlike his British counterparts, who will run machinery and run it and fix it and repair it and kind of toggle it together, Carnegie says that's foolish. He says, run the stuff into the ground, because when you replace it, it's going to be so much better and so much more efficient, it will pay for itself. He takes a group of these British industrialists on a tour one time, shows them he's got all the latest stuff. And they say, how can you afford to have all this? And he says, how can you afford not to? And he doesn't say, but he's thinking, surely, and that's why I'm eating your lunch. So by the time he becomes the largest steel producer on the planet, thanks to all that, partly right place, right time. Part of it is he's very shrewd about things like vertical economic integration. He's very shrewd about prices and strategies. And so when he sells his company to J.P. Morgan to create U.S. Steel, Morgan writes him and says, congratulations on being the richest man in the world. Is he? He might be the world's first billionaire. He and Rockefeller probably hit it right about the same moment. Morgan's not even a player, by the way, in that race. So we've got his narrative of, well, it's all about progress. And as the nation grew and the nation progressed, so too did I. And there is some truth to that.
You were talking about steel in particular. And steel does bring out one of the great contradictions in his personality, particularly the events around
the Homestead Steel Strike. What happened there?
We certainly do have that contradiction. The background on this, by the way, is in 1886, Carnegie purchases the Homestead Works, which is making rolled steel, flat stuff, an expanding market. And with that, he inherits the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers, the Union of Skilled Workers, which are only about 20% of the people working there. They've got a contract, comes up in 1889. They go on strike. Carnegie comes in. He says, what do you want? They tell him. He says, fine, take it. Now let's get back to work. And it's a three-year contract till 1892. In the meantime, he's got a couple of things happen in 1892. One is they reorganized the company and put Henry Clay Frick in charge of it as its CEO, if you will. Henry Clay Frick came in through the coal and coke business. He is one of the great, notorious union haters of all American history. And he's got a lot of competition, and I know that, and he's still kind of a Hall of Fame kind of guy. The other thing that happens is the United States government has signed a contract with Carnegie Steel through the Homestead Works for a whole lot of this rolled steel as battleships and naval ships are becoming steel clad. So these two things happen when the union contract is coming due on July 1st of 1892. Frick wants nothing to do with signing a new contract with the union. He wants them gone. The union's trying to get some wage changes. Carnegie, meantime, leaves the country. In March, he leaves for his annual trip to Scotland. He used to go for 5 or 6 months. He'd suffered heat stroke, and so going a cool place was a good idea for him. He leaves Frick in charge. He even says, whatever you do, I'm sure we'll be behind it. And then he kind of goes incommunicado while he leaves Henry Clay Frick in charge of the problem. Well, they lock out the union in early July. Frick calls in 300, count them, 300 Pinkertons. A battle ensues. There are deaths, there are injuries, this entire town and the Pinkertons are going at it. When they finally settle everything, they start hiring people back at lower wages, everybody but the organizers. For Carnegie, this is a black eye for the guy who has always claimed to be one of the great friends of the working man. He writes a piece in 1886, in fact, in which he says the interest of capital and labor are one. Well, maybe, but maybe not the way he's acting. And some have argued that the reason we don't see Carnegie Carnegie as this evil union breaker is because of the philanthropy. He successfully brands himself in the aftermath of Homestead. Now, if you want to read some great fiction about this, and I love fiction, I read a lot of it, but if you want to read some great fiction on this, pick up Carnegie's autobiography and read the chapter. It's a delightful work of fiction. Oh, he says, oh, it was a black spot on his heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did he legitimately see himself as a friend to labor and possibly even not anti-union?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really does. Part of it has to do, the devil is sort of in the details of definitions of terms. When he talks about, quote, union, he means something in-house, within the company, not unlike your student government in high school, or not unlike in our business, a faculty council, where you have representatives of those who work there who are going to be making recommendations and they're going to work with management to come up with solutions to problems. He thought that was a great idea. What he doesn't like are national unions. And his argument is these are folks on the outside who don't really understand our specific and particular case. And the problems at Carnegie Steel are not the same at Empire Steel or any other steel company. And therefore, they really shouldn't have a voice in our company with our people because they're a bunch of outsiders. So he does see himself as a friend of it. He sees himself as liking unions. It's just a matter of how you want to define, quote, union.
Let's talk about his philanthropy.
And there's a lot to it, but I think I'd like to start with the thing that's most obvious to most Americans, and that's libraries. Why is his interest in libraries so strong?
Carnegie's what we would today call a lifelong learner. He was a voracious reader. He read many things. He remembered what he read. Really goes back to this experience when they first moved to Pittsburgh, and he's got a job, these factory jobs, and there was a guy there by the name of Anderson, a Colonel Anderson. Ah, he says, a man who is forever have a warm spot in his heart. We had a personal library, 800 or so volumes apparently. And on Saturday afternoons, he opened it up to, quote, working boys, guys like young telegrapher Andy Carnegie, and they could borrow one book. And, oh, Carnegie describes it in his autobiography. He says, ah, and he sat there as chief magistrate and librarian himself. And the deal was you could check out one book and bring it back next week and get another one. And he later said that he was convinced that he became who he was because he had access to a free public library. And it plays into his belief in libraries. And by the way, the key thing is free public. There are libraries around. I mean, right here in St. Louis, for example, starting in 1846, there was a mercantile library. You had to be a member to join and to use it. And these kinds of membership or subscription libraries were not unusual. But something that would free and open to anybody was a new idea when he starts really pushing it in the late 1880s. It ties into his views, not just this old memory of Colonel Anderson, but it also ties into his views about self-help. This is the same time period that brings you the Horatio Alger stories. The honest, hard-working lad who keeps his nose to the grindstone and works his way up and pulls himself up by the bootstraps. Booker T. Washington sees himself as that kind of a story. Read Up From Slavery. It's Horatio Alger goes Booker. And Carnegie sees himself that way, too. At one point, he says they are the most democratic institutions of all. He calls them temples of democracy because, he said, free public libraries are the only institution that will only help those who help themselves. And he's all about self-help. The rags to riches story is all about self-help. So he sees himself that way, and he says, I want to let everybody else have that opportunity. And the way he does it is he says to a community, he says openly, here's how it's going to work. You, community X, you provide the lot, and you agree to tax yourself to pay for the operation. And he says, I'll build the building. And he does so, but what he's saying is this. He says, hey, look, I believe in progress, and I believe that the more people who go to this library, the more it's going to evolve, and it's going to expand, and the city's going to grow, and we're going to have these people coming in who improve themselves, and they become millionaires, and they're going to give all their money away and create more opportunities, and so it goes. And he says, and because it's tied to tax, as the community grows, the tax revenue will grow too. And as it grows too, the library will always keep up. No matter how big the city gets or the town gets, the library will keep up because it's tied to those tax dollars. So his premise is that. And what he really does is he changes this entire narrative about free public libraries. It probably doesn't occur to you or me that we could not go into a public library. We can go in walk in the door, read a magazine, look at the books, sit there all day if we want to, because it's a free public library. It would never occur to us to pay for that. And that's because we have this notion that these libraries are supposed to be free. And Carnegie does that. He pays for something like 2,600 of these around the planet. He pays for 1,600 or 1,700 of them in about 1,500 or so communities. When you do that, you really do change the narrative about how we go about paying for this institution and the role of this institution in a given community. And that's perhaps one of the great transformations that he takes on through this philanthropy.
Does he set up a process for communities being able to do this?
Around the time he retired, Carnegie later said that he went from his retail to his wholesale stage. And one of the things he starts doing is trying to systematize it. And he's got a secretary by the name of James Bertram, who's the main guy on this. He's the one who's orchestrating all this. And so they set up a series of rules. They say, okay, communities with population of X to Y are going to get a $500 library. And from Y to Z, you're going to get a $1,000 library and so forth. And they start out by saying to communities, okay, we need the following information from you. Do you have the tax? What's your population? So on and so forth. Bertram says, we need to standardize this. Oh, classic progressive thinking, right? This guy's a progressive right out of the book. He says, what we need here is a form. You and I would look at this today and say, in fact, I'll bet Microsoft even makes one I can just use. I mean, it's so common today, but it's not then. And Bertram says, what we need here is a form, y'all. We need something that we want the following information, fill it in, send it. And in fact, they even get to a place where they say, tell you what, we'll even send you blueprints for a $500 library, for a $1,500 library. And that's in part because there's some pretty ugly stuff going up around America. You know, they're just kind of making it up. And they say, tell you what, let me help you with this. And so James Bertram creates what amounts to the first grant application form. It's like, of course that happens. We have a form for everything. You and I teach at a university, and we're no different than any other university in America. There's a form for everything. And that makes sense. It's a way of systematizing the information. But he even revolutionizes the way people ask for and receive philanthropic dollars.
One of the things that's interesting about Carnegie in particular is his idea that he's made all this money, but now that I've made it,
he wants to, in a sense, die poor.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
Well, that's a great question. In part, it comes from his belief in self-help, but more importantly, it comes from his belief in progress. He thinks of himself as believing in his version, at least, of evolution. He says, he thinks Herbert Spencer is on the right track with this, how societies evolve toward perfection. In fact, most of what he writes does not agree with Spencer. He met Spencer one time, by the way. He charted a transatlantic trip coming to the United States, and he managed to get himself booked on the same one as Herbert Spencer. Spencer's only trip to the United States. And so he makes sure he sits at his table and he talks to him because he's this very gregarious guy. And he invites him to come see your philosophy and work. Come to a steel mill in Pittsburgh. Well, begrudgingly, finally, Spencer says, well, okay. So he shows up. Carnegie takes him on the tour, and it's a steel mill. It is hot, smoky, loud. They're molten metal. It's this kind of an environment. And they get out to the end and Carnegie says, what do you think? And all Spencer can say is, what's he say? A week here would justify suicide. So he sees himself as an evolutionist, if you will, and these communities are going to evolve. And here's what he says. He says, look, as we as a nation have evolved and improved in more trains and more railroads and all the rest, he said, so too have I. I've advanced along with it, thanks to the advancement and the progress of the nation. Which is, quote, what canon of justice would be violated if the community did not want something back in return? So he says, that's what I'm here to do, is now to do that. And the idea is to plow all that money back into the community in ways that allow lots of other people to have that same potential benefit of self-improvement and become millionaires themselves. He says, the idea is to give it all away, but to do it scientifically. He's got a real problem with this Rockefeller give dimes to kids on the streets. Is that going to do any good? He says, you need to be strategic about it. And so he says, I want to advance democracy. I want to advance progress. And I see these things as doing that. I see free public libraries as doing that. I see international peace as doing that, and so forth. So I'm going to fund those, and I want to put all my money into that so that more people advance and they give their money away and make more opportunities. In fact, in 1913, he writes about this and he says, until we achieve the ideal of the socialist when all shall have enough. So for him, the philanthropy has to do with this progress of a democracy idea.
How did his contemporaries view him, both as an industrialist and a philanthropist?
Well, mixed, as you might guess. Some folks go along with it. There are those, in fact, that will even pay for free public libraries in some cases, that will give money away and in some cases willingly. Others, more begrudgingly. When Jay Gould died in the 1890s, it was widely reported that it had been the death of the most hated man in America, and he might have been. But boy, he sure had competition. And probably one of his great competitors was John Rockefeller, Standard Oil. And Rockefeller was just despised in the public eye. And Rockefeller goes through what amounts to a rebranding of himself. And the rebrand is to start giving money away and to look like a good guy, essentially. And Rockefeller is interested in higher education. He's interested in medical research and scientific research. At one point, Carnegie, in fact, when people would ask him for money for things like a hospital, he would tell me, he'd say, oh, talk to Rockefeller about that. He'll pay for it, which I'm sure John D. just loved. But he would say about Rockefeller, well, at least he's doing it scientifically. He says, this is what I'm interested in. This is what I'm going to pay for. So some more so than others. And we see this even today with modern philanthropists. We've got people like Warren Buffett who have said they're going to give all this money away. And there are others who have said, yes, I'm going to give away a lot of my money too. And then there are others like Jeff Bezos who've said, or not so much. You know, flight in space actually sounds a lot cooler to me right now. So just as now, so too then, there's a wide variety of views among his contemporaries.
How might Andrew Carnegie have responded to individuals such as Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos?
Well, differently, I think. I think he would look at a guy like Bill Gates and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and say, that's how you're supposed to do it. He says, that doesn't happen to be my cause, but that's yours, and you're doing it scientifically, and you're doing it actively, and you're really trying to make a change. Carnegie's more interested in the American case than the global one, although he pays for libraries all through the English-speaking world. He used to joke that the sun never sets on a Carnegie library. And he would say to guys like Buffett, at least you're doing that. It's not like you're just randomly giving money away. I think he would say to the Jeff Bezoses of the world or the Elon Musks of the world, what are you going to do with all that money? I mean, seems like there's a better way to improve society than free overnight shipping. And I think Carnegie would be pretty critical. This is a guy who favored the first income tax because it was a tax on the rich. Something like 80% of Americans paid no income tax because they didn't make enough. And Carnegie even writes, it's a good idea. He says it's common sense because it's only for tax the rich and not everybody sort of gets the memo, if you will. He would today be saying to our Congress, I think, you know, taxing the very, very rich at a higher rate is probably a good idea because you know what? They don't all get the memo about giving away their money.
Are there causes other than libraries in particular that Carnegie was really passionate about?
Well, one of them, if you listen to public radio or watch public television, you've heard of is the Carnegie Institute, Carnegie Endowment for the Arts, which funds all kinds of those sorts of things. And he initially funds that. You know, he's getting to be a man around 70, and he starts realizing that the chronology is catching up with him. And so he says, my God, what if I die and I haven't given all my money away? And so he creates the Carnegie Endowment for the Arts primarily as a way to dump his wealth in there. So it's given away and it's going to keep running afterward. And it does. He funds the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh. In fact, at the Natural History Museum, he displayed the skeleton of a dinosaur that had been named after him, the Diplodocus carnegii. So he's got that going, and free on Sundays, but still free to workers. The other thing he's very interested in, became very interested in, was international peace. He felt that war was outmoded. He felt it was what hindered progress. It hindered democracy. So he attended the Hague Conference in the 90s, for example, as an American delegate. And he felt that, therefore, we need to live in a world marked by peace because that's what's standing in the road of progress. He pays for the Carnegie Endowment for International international peace. He helps fund the World Court at The Hague. He even funds the Simplified Spelling Board, puts money into this for several years, 8 or 10 years. And he says, part of the trouble with international relations is we have these different languages and we don't all understand them. And he says, and the problem is English is hard. Of course, he picks English to be the international language. It's his. And he uses the suffix O-U-G-H. He says, what about rough, cough, though, through? He says, we need to simplify the spelling. And he has a handful of words. And he gets a bunch of people to sign on to use this, quote, simplified spelling. Theodore Roosevelt goes along with it. Mark Twain goes along with it. In fact, when he finally decided it wasn't working, quit paying for it, Twain said he was so disappointed. He did so much love violence and revolution. So he's got these notions that, in fact, you and I are beneficiaries of one of those. He was on the board at Cornell for a brief time, and he noticed that college professors, they were working until they died because they couldn't afford to retire. And so he creates an endowment that becomes TIAA, which is how you and I are ultimately going to be able to retire. That plus Franklin Roosevelt is what's going to help us retire. And that's Andrew Carnegie at work as well.
Finishing up, we almost always forget spouses here, but his spouse was a very important player, particularly in his philanthropy.
Yes, Louise is an interesting figure. She was a generation younger than he was. He was 3 years younger than his father-in-law. They didn't marry. They were an item for a number of years before they married. I mean, when I say a number, I mean like 3 or 4. It's unclear whether he had willingly promised or whether his mother, Margaret, who was something of a battle axe, extracted it. But he had promised her that he would never marry as long as she was living. And so Andy and Louise, they're kind of drumming their fingers and biding their time for a couple of years, waiting for her to finally move on. She died in the late fall, and they married the following April. Louise was very much in favor of his views about philanthropy. And he says in his will, he says, I'm not leaving her anything because she's already taken care of. And that was true. There's the one story about Carnegie Hall. Here's how the Carnegie Hall system worked at the time. Every year, they would get to the end of the year, they'd have a deficit. The secretary goes to see Carnegie and says, we have a deficit this year. And Carnegie says, done. And he writes him a check. Every year. One year he goes in, and it's a big number this year. It's like $25,000. It's a lot. And Carnegie looks at him and he says, you know, I cannot believe I'm the only music lover in the city of New York. There's got to be somebody else. I'll tell you what, I'll give you half when you come up with the other half. Secretary says, well, okay. Leaves. Comes back just a few days later, handful of days. Comes in and says, well, I got it. And Carnegie says to him, none of my business, but where'd you come up with that kind of money that fast? And he said, oh, Mrs. Carnegie. They're very much on the same path. And the fact is, there is no Carnegie wealth today because he gave it all away. Carnegie would say, this proves my point. There's no Astor money today either because John Jacob Astor collected all that money and he left it to his kids and they left it to their kids and they spent it and they burned through it and now there's none left. Carnegie would look at that and he'd say, see, that's what I've been telling you about this inherited wealth stuff, man. Nothing destroys people quite like inherited wealth. He'd say, if I were talking to old John Jacob Astor, I'd have told him, don't leave it to those kids. Look what they're going to do to it. And sure enough, that's what happened in the Astor case. So there's no Carnegie money. There's no Astor money for much the same reasons.
So if we're going to sum up Andrew Carnegie maybe in a sentence, what might that be?
Boy, that's a great question. Here's the thing. There are no good guys and there are no bad guys. There are some pretty bad guys. And there are some pretty good guys in history, but trying to figure out where people are on the spectrum is always difficult. And in Carnegie's case, I think he is a transformative figure, not just in the American economy, but also in American social life. He transforms the way we think about the relationship between philanthropy and giving away money and the society at large and what that relationship ought to look like. And I think he is the one who transforms that view and starts what has turned out to be a more than a century and a half conversation about, so what should people do with excess money?
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been delightful.
And we'll be back soon.